Once again in the session now after lunch, we're going to be going back into the preliminary practices, the so-called foundation practices for Maha Mudra. So let's begin with a meditation and then we'll have a little bit more look at the preliminaries according to the text. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, allow your awareness to descend into the body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. So let's now have a look at some ways of dealing with attachment. Attachment is defined as a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness and then wishes to possess and hold the object. Thinking that that object is a source of our happiness. So let's now have a look at some different ways of dealing with attachment. So first, bring to mind a person towards whom you have attachment. A person who seems to be crucial to your happiness. Or alternatively, you can focus on an object that seems to be crucial to your happiness. And then imagine that you actually have your object of attachment, that personal thing, and you're holding on to it very tightly, not wanting to lose that personal thing. How does your attachment make you feel? Are you calm and relaxed? Does that personal thing have the power to bring you lasting happiness? Now, if we mentally relax our grip on that personal thing, allowing some space, allowing it to be, how How do you feel? Are you more calm and relaxed? Without the clinging, are you more able to enjoy the presence of that person or thing? Now recall that the person or thing that you're attached to or have attachment for is impermanent, changing moment to moment. In a constant state of change, not remaining the same from one moment to the next. In seeing this, check whether your attachment to that person or thing remains the same. Now imagine that person or thing changing over time and becoming very old. And again, check whether your attachment to that person or thing remains the same, seeing the person or thing as very old. And again, imagine the person or thing you're attached to very clearly in front of you. What is it exactly that makes that person or thing so desirable, so attractive? So mentally dissect that person or thing into its parts and try to pinpoint precisely what it is that is so attractive, so desirable. Now try to think of someone else who may not see your object of attachment as attractive or desirable. Is their perception invalid? Are you seeing that person or thing in the correct way while they are mistaken? Or is it that due to your own experience, you are correctly labeling that person or thing as attractive? And that due to the other person having a different experience, they are correctly labeling that person in a very different way? And then due to your labeling that person or thing as attractive, are you then going on to seeing that person or thing as inherently attractive? Attractive from its own side. And as a result, do you develop some attachment, seeing that person or thing as the source of your happiness? Nothing is inherently one way or another. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And by realizing this, then whether it is a relationship with another person or simply eating a delicious piece of chocolate cake, we won't cling to that experience. And as a result, we'll enjoy it more fully. So in conclusion, recognize that it's possible to practice these methods of letting go of attachment, and that when we do, we'll feel more balanced and free to enjoy things without clinging. more balanced and free to enjoy and improve our relationships with others. And make a strong determination to do so. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply be present. Just be. Without doing anything at all. Simply be aware of being aware. So let's go back and continue to look at the preliminaries or foundation practices for Mahamudra. So we're on the first page of the text, page one, down towards the bottom. And yesterday we briefly mentioned this paragraph that starts in general. As a preliminary to giving any profound instructions or engaging in meditation, all the holy beings of different traditions in Tibet concord in doing what is called the four guiding instructions. So these four practices of going for refuge in generating bodhicitta, vajrasattva meditation, mandala offering, and guru yoga. These are what's called the four uncommon or special preliminaries. Yesterday we saw that we can talk about what's called the four common preliminaries, these four thoughts, the four thoughts that turn the mind toward Dharma. You know, we looked at precious human life and death and karma and the unsatisfactory nature of samsara. These are called the four common preliminaries, because they're the preliminaries or foundation in common to all practices, all the various Mahayana practices. Whereas here, these four things are the four special or uncommon preliminaries, which are preliminaries to the Tantra level of Mahayana practice. And we're going to start to have a look at those tomorrow. So if we continue on there, and then it says, in particular, with regard to first meditating on loving kindness, compassion, bodhicitta, renunciation, karma, death and impermanence. So these are all part of the preliminaries or foundation for Mahamudra practice. the supreme disciple of highest yoga tantra, the lord of yogis, Milarepa. So Milarepa, of course, is within the Mahamudra tradition lineage, that Milarepa was the main disciple of Marpa, who received the instructions from the great Indian master Naropa. And then Milarepa's main disciple was Gampopa, who's really the founder of the Kagyu school. Milarepa is often considered to be the greatest yogi in the history of Tibet. So he also gave advice saying, and he says, being very afraid of the eight states of non-leisure, so this is reflecting on precious human life, I meditated on death and the disadvantages of samsara. So that's the second of the four common preliminaries, death and impermanence, and the last one, the unsatisfactory nature of samsara. Meticulously followed the principles of karma, the law of cause and effect. So that's the third of the common preliminaries. So he's mentioned all the four common preliminaries here, which we remember to help us to be able to go for refuge in bodhicitta without them being merely words from our mouth. So because he reflected on them, he said, then he constantly entrusted myself to the three jewels of refuge. And then he also, having trained my mental continuum in the method of bodhicitta, I cut the flow of latency obscurations. So these obscurations, very briefly the other day we mentioned that there are two obscurations that the, you know, we said in the title, the main path of the victor. The victor was another name for the Buddha, and a victor was someone who gained victory over the two obscurations. And they were, and we're going to look at these in more detail later, they were the afflictive obscurations, so all the mental afflictions and ignorance, and the cognitive obscurations, which I briefly mentioned were the stains in our mind. So that's what he talks about here as the latency obscuration. Latency here is another word for stain. So he managed to eliminate both of these obscurations and realized that all appearances are like illusions, so meaning he's come to realize emptiness. And then he very humbly says, I am now without any fear of the three lower realms, meaning really he's achieved enlightenment. But he's saying it in a very, very sort of humble way. So he's basically saying that he also followed this structure, the common preliminaries and so forth, in order to achieve enlightenment. And then if we look at the next quote here, this is a very short text, four-line text. Drukpa Gyaltsen, as one of the great masters within the Sakya tradition. So these parting from the four attachments, this text is a very common text that is taught in the Sakya, but also in the Kagyu tradition, very commonly taught. So he's quoting here Drukpa Gyaltsen, great Tibetan master, who says, if you are attached to this life, you are not a true spiritual practitioner. So now, of course, we are attached to this life, meaning what that means is we are looking out there for happiness. And so now we are caught in what's called the eight worldly concerns. Because we are looking for happiness in this life, meaning out here, and we also believe the source of our suffering is out there. So we end up having a lot of craving and attachment to the pleasant things and a lot of aversion to the unpleasant things. And this is summarized in a presentation called the Eight Worldly Concerns, which are four pairs of things. One thing we're trying to get hold of, because it seems to be the source of our happiness, and the other thing we're trying to push away or avoid because it seems to be the source of our suffering.
And the first pair is gain and loss. This is material gain. So we often feel that in order for us to be happy, we need more stuff, we need more wealth, more things, material things. So we put a lot of effort in trying to get more stuff, more money, more things. Because it seems like the more we have, the more likely we will be happy. And of course, we often feel as if we don't have these things, we're going to suffer. So we avoid loss, losing these or not having all of this stuff. The second pair is pleasure and pain, because we often identify pleasure as happiness, so we feel if to be happy, we need more pleasure. So we put a lot of effort in gaining more pleasurable experiences, the so-called sense pleasures, all sorts of pleasurable experiences. We put a lot of effort in having as much pleasurable experiences as possible in the hope that we'll be more happy. And of course, any unpleasant, painful experiences, we identify as suffering, so we push away or avoid any sort of pain. But also we feel it's very important what people say about us in order for us to be happy. So the third pair is praise and blame. So we put a lot of effort in so that people praise us, say good things about us, because we feel if they don't, we're not going to be happy. That if they do, we're going to be more happy. And of course, blame seems to be the source of suffering, so we try to avoid situations where people are blaming us, particularly for things we never did. But not only do we feel it important for our happiness what people are saying about us, but we also feel important for our happiness what people are thinking about us. And so the fourth pair is good and reputation, good and bad reputation. So we put a lot of effort to try to cultivate a good reputation, that people respect us, acknowledge us, look up to us and so forth. And we try to avoid having bad reputation because we believe or feel that that's going to be a source of suffering. So we put a lot of effort into the things on the left. They seem to be the source of our happiness. And we try to avoid the things on the right. So we end up with attachment to this and aversion to this. And so this is really what's being said here. If you are attached to this life, you are not a true spiritual practitioner. Meaning, if you're attached to these things and hope that they are going to make us happy, that that's the source of our happiness, then you're not a true spiritual practitioner. So if we can reflect on the fact that these are not the source of genuine happiness and stop having attachment to them and start to look inside of ourselves, then we really become a spiritual practitioner. As we go through each one of these, there's an explanation about that on the following page, so we'll do the explanation as we go. So the first one, it says, as an antidote to being attached to this life, it is necessary to train in the practices of the initial capacity person, such as reflecting on the freedoms and opportunities, impermanence and suffering of the lower realms. So here it means that to reflect on our precious human life and death, and also so to stop looking out here for happiness and start to look inside of ourselves. And then the second one, it says, if you are attached to samsara, you do not have renunciation. So how to overcome that? So attached to samsara,
You do not have renunciation. So remember, renunciation is the wish for liberation from samsara. So to develop that, how do we do that? Over page 2 it says, as an antidote to being attached to samsara, it is necessary to train in the three higher trainings. Three higher trainings, of course, is ethics, concentration, wisdom. Having understood that all the entire samsara is in the nature of suffering. So this is, again, to reflect on this idea of dukkha, the first noble truth, to understand that source of suffering is within ourselves, to understand the second noble truth, the source of dukkha, the mental afflictions are the source of suffering, and then, on the basis of ethical lifestyle, develop concentration and develop wisdom to overcome these mental afflictions, these three higher trainings. And then the third point is, if you are attached to your own self-interest, you do not have bodhicitta. Meaning, if you have self-cherishing, you're putting your happiness above the happiness of others, then of course you won't have bodhicitta. Because bodhicitta is the aspiration to help to liberate everyone else from suffering. So that's the opposite of this selfish, self-centered attitude of self-cherishing. So it says, as an antidote to seeking peace and happiness for oneself alone, meditate on loving kindness, compassion, bodhicitta. So again, as a basis to cultivate these four immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, and then on that basis to go on to cultivate the aspiration of bodhicitta. And that's an antidote to this. So then we can actually enter into the Mahayana path. So the first of the four statements is, if we get rid of attachment to this life, then we actually become a spiritual practitioner. If we then let go of attachment to samsara, meaning attachment out there, then we have renunciation, we'll enter into the Theravada level of the path. And then if we let go of attachment to our own self-interest and cultivate bodhicitta, then we have the entry point into the Mahayana path to enlightenment. And then the fourth point says, if there is grasping here means grasping onto inherent or independent existence, you do not have the correct view of reality. So it says, as an antidote to self-grasping, meaning grasping onto an independent me, that is the root of samsara. So here, where, and this is what emptiness is all about, emptiness is the antidote to self-grasping, which is the root of samsara. This self-grasping or fundamental ignorance is a grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. So then it says it is necessary to meditate on the selflessness of person and phenomena. Here, selflessness is actually synonymous with emptiness. So this is a very famous text, this parting from the four attachments, which also sort of maps out in a step-by-step way the path to enlightenment. Just as we saw in Milarepa's quote, he stepped out in a step-by-step way how to follow the path to enlightenment. So these, of course, are all the foundation practices that we need to develop in a step-by-step way as a basis for entering into the Mahamudra practice. Any questions on any of that so far?
And so phenomena means...
Phenomena just means anything that exists. Existence. And here's a very important point in the sentence that follows. It says, since in their treatises on authentic sutras and tantras, every Indian and Tibetan scholar and adept praise those paths highly. Those paths are the ones we've just talked about. Do not think that they are merely preliminaries, even though they have been explained in the context of the preliminaries, but rather practice them by integrating them into your actual practice. So again, I think I already mentioned this earlier. Often when people see this word preliminaries, they have the idea that, oh, that's something to do as a beginner. Once I've done that, I can sort of, you know, move on to more advanced things and forget about these practices, because they're just preliminaries. They're just something you do at the start and then you leave them behind, forget about them. So here he's saying that this is not how we should see these preliminaries. Rather, that they're foundation. So we need to integrate them into our actual practice. Means we need to continue to cultivate these, because these are the things that are supporting our whole Mahamudra practice. So if we don't continue to cultivate them and integrate them, then those foundation will slowly crumble and then our whole Mahamudra practice will come crashing down. So these are something that we need to continue to work on, all of these practices, you know, as Milarepa said, to reflect on precious human life, reflecting on death, the disadvantages of samsara, to have an ethical lifestyle, to go for refuge, to generate bodhicitta, to cultivate loving kindness and compassion. These are things that we need to continually cultivate. Otherwise, they will slowly dissipate and will have no basis for Mahamudra practice. So that's what we need to really understand here. What I'd like to do now is go back to Milarepa. In the third line of his quote, he said, he meticulously followed the principles of karma, the law of cause and effect. Meaning, by reflecting on karma and the principles of karma, then we will meticulously follow an ethical lifestyle, because we'll understand from this presentation, if we do a harmful behavior, we end up with suffering. Do a virtuous behavior, we have a happiness experience. So what I'd like to do now is have a look at some the fundamental ethics within Buddhism.
And in terms of ethics, of course, we can talk about verbal and physical behavior. But of course, and we can restrain ourselves at a verbal and physical level in terms of harmful behavior. But if we're not addressing mental negative states of mind, then it's going to be very hard to restrain ourselves at the verbal and physical level. So if we want an ethical basis, we need to attend to all three areas, not only the verbal and physical, but the mental. So then we can talk about adopting an ethical lifestyle that covers all three areas. And in the fundamental basis of ethics, then the Buddha talked about avoiding what's called the 10 non-virtues. And so usually when we talk about virtues, the 10 virtues, they are simply listed as avoiding or abandoning the non-virtue. But I think in our modern society, particularly because we have so much focus on the negative, that it's much better to focus on the positive opposite. Because as great modern-day philosopher William James said, what we attend to becomes our reality. So if we're always focusing on the negative, even in terms of not doing that, that's what we're focusing on. That becomes our reality. And I think that's why Mother Teresa said she would never attend an anti-war rally, but she would always attend a peace rally. And also, you know, so we have so much focus on the negative. And here, then, as they're listed, they're saying, don't do this, don't do that, don't do that. And also, we tend not to like it when people tell us what not to do. We don't really like that. Even if it's a valid thing, we don't like people saying that to us. So therefore, I think it's much better, more helpful to list these 10 virtues
in terms of the positive opposite. And so that's what we're going to do. Because also another example is, like, let's say we want to give up smoking. Then if we just simply remind ourselves, I don't want to smoke, I don't want to smoke, I don't want to smoke, what are we focusing on? Is smoking. Not so good. Rather, focus on the positive opposite, like, I want to be healthy, I want healthy lungs or something. You know? And another classic example is, let's say we're at home and we're about to go out and we have to take some keys with us. Then often we go, okay, don't forget the keys, don't forget the keys, don't forget the keys. And what do? We walk out the door without the keys. Because what that translates into is forget, forget, forget. And so we do. So rather than don't forget the keys, we need to have remember the keys, remember the keys, remember the keys. So that's what I'd like to do now, is to make a list of the positive opposites. Because normally the 10 virtues are listed as don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. The first non-virtue that it says don't engage in is killing. So what's the positive opposite of killing? Save lives is very proactive. What would be the sort of minimum positive opposite?
Maintain life.
Protect.
Protect is also very proactive. What would be sort of the minimum?
Take care.
Take care is proactive. I mean, it's good, but what would be the minimum sort of positive opposite of killing? Respect life? So again, if we want to be more proactive, we would protect life and so forth. The second non-virtue is stealing. So what's the positive opposite of stealing? Again, giving is very proactive, very good. What would be sort of the minimum positive opposite?
Respect others' property.
The third non-virtue, physical level, is sexual misconduct. And sexual misconduct is defined as any sexual conduct that creates harm. So what's the positive opposite of sexual misconduct? I think this one's a little bit more difficult to frame.
Respect sexual choices.
Exactly. It's basically to usually sexual misconduct comes because we're not respecting others' boundaries or whatever you want to say. So it's the same idea, yes. So they are the physical. The next four are verbal behaviors. The fourth non-virtue is lying. So what's the positive opposite of lying? Telling the truth. The fifth non-virtue is what's called divisive speech. And divisive speech is any sort of speech whereby your intention is to cause two people or two groups of people to move apart, to divide them. So what's the positive opposite of divisive speech?
Peaceful.
Harmonizing speech. Yes, bringing people together. The sixth non-virtue is what's called harsh speech. And harsh speech is defined as any speech whereby your intention is to hurt the person by what you say. So what's the positive opposite of harsh speech?
Polite.
Kind, yeah, kind.
Supportive.
Yeah, kind speech.
The seventh non-virtue is what's called idle gossip or senseless speech. Now here, this is like the top 10 list. But when we look at idle gossip or senseless speech, it seems quite harmless. Why does that make the top 10 list when it seems so harmless? Why is idle gossip or senseless speech there? Sorry? We just waste all of our time. Exactly. So what's the positive opposite of idle gossip or senseless speech? Meaningful speech. So these are the four verbal behaviours. And then, of course, if we don't address the underlying mental negative states of mind, then it's going to be hard to do this. So the last three are mental non-virtues we're trying to overcome. The eighth one, the non-virtue, often is translated into English as covetousness, which is not an often used word. Covetousness has the meaning that we're wanting something belonging to someone else. So that, and of course, if we act that out, we end up stealing, for example. But covetousness is wanting something belonging to someone else. So what's the sort of positive opposite of this? And I think here I can think of two things that are helpful.
Rejoicing in other people's belongings.
Rejoicing in others' good fortune, yes. Because again, if someone else has something, we often become very jealous. And what's the other one that is quite helpful here? Positive opposite to overcome covetousness.
Generosity.
Being content.
Being content with what we have. We saw that already as one of the prerequisites for the shamatha practice, yeah? The ninth non-virtue is
being content with what you have is like
physical stuff.
Yeah, satisfied with what you have.
Yeah, so we're not going to covet other people's things if we're happy with what we've got. Ninth non-virtue is what's called ill will or malice, and this is the mind of wishing to harm or wishing that some harm befall some person. So what's the positive opposite of ill will or malice?
Goodwill
or
compassion
and loving kindness. Loving kindness, the wish them to be happy. Compassion, the wish them to be free of suffering. Because ill will and malice is a wish for them to suffer. And the tenth non-virtue is listed as wrong view. And here, and there can be many types of wrong view, but here, the main wrong view that is pointed out or indicated is the wrong view that there are no consequences to my actions. I can do whatever I want. So what's the positive opposite of wrong view? Right view or wisdom. So these are the three mental attitudes. So I think if we want to have an ethical lifestyle, much better to focus on these positive points rather than think about not killing, not stealing, and so forth. So, and it feels much nicer if we want to like respect life, respect others' property and boundaries, to tell the truth, to harmonize speech, kind and meaningful speech, rejoicing in others' good fortune, being content, and having loving kindness, compassion, and wisdom. So I think this is a very good basis for ethical lifestyle.
And so this is really what Milarepa is indicating when he says, meticulously follow the principles of karma, the law of cause and effect. That through understanding the principles of cause and effect, he meticulously adopted an ethical lifestyle. And so, of course, this is the basis of all Buddhist traditions, and I think it's the basis of any sort of meaningful lifestyle. So that's a little bit about the 10 virtues or ethics. Any questions about that before we go for a tea break? So in the preliminaries so far, we've now looked at these four thoughts, the common preliminaries, and we've looked at the structure of the practices of how to have a basis for Mahamudra, and I want to go over that again tomorrow a little bit in terms of the Lam Rim, because I think a number of you are a little bit familiar with the Lam Rim structure, and that's sort of what has been indicated a little bit in Milarepa's quote, a little bit the Lam Rim. You can see a little bit the Lam Rim structure there. So I want to put that together to get a clearer picture of how these preliminaries or foundation practices fit together and in what order to cultivate them. And then I'd like to move on to the next section of the preliminaries, which is going back, is talking about these four uncommon or special preliminaries, this going for refuge, bodhicitta, vajrasattva meditation, mandala offering, guru yoga. So I want to comment a little bit on those, so I'll probably start that a little bit tomorrow and the following day as well, maybe the following 2 days, because there's quite a lot to be talked about in this area. So that's what's coming. Okay, so let's have a tea break and then come back at 3:30.